If your restaurant wants to put the best on the table, look for food with a New York State certified seal. It's food that is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to The Line. I'm Eli Sussman, your host. Today, I'm joined by Dookie Hong. Dookie grew up in Leonia, New Jersey. When he was 15 years old, he got a job cooking for Aaron Sanchez in New York City. He later attended the CIA, and after graduating, worked for David Chang and at the three Michelin star Jean Georges. Until recently, he was the executive chef of Kang Ho-dong Bakjang in Manhattan's Koreatown. He is the co-author of the cookbook Koreatown, and all that just shy of his 28th birthday. Dookie, thanks for being with us on The Line.
No, thank you so much, Eli. Really honored to be on your platform today. And yeah, super excited. Let's get to it.
Totally, man. Okay, so you started your cooking career in an interesting way. Mm-hmm. You had a teammate on your baseball team.
Yeah.
His dad was a partner of Drew Nyport.
Yeah.
Who started Nobu. He has a ton of restaurants in the city. He's been in 35-year restaurant veteran. Okay,
absolutely.
So did you just go up to your friend and ask his dad for a job? How did you get involved?
No, not at all. It was a really weird thing. Obviously, all of this knowledge is not known to me at that age. I don't know who Junior Porn is. I don't know any of this stuff. But yeah, I was just playing and, you know, just talking to him. I was really involved in the home ec program in my school. And I think my coach, his name is Michael Bonides, who's now my mentor in this industry. He was just like, hey, like, if you're interested, I heard that you're interested in cooking, food, whatnot. If you want to cook, come by. We're opening up this restaurant, which was Centrico with Chef Aaron Sanchez. If you want to come by, help out, great. If you don't want to come by, how about great? You know, it was very, very laissez-faire, you know, but he was saying this door is available to you. It's up to you.
So he was non-committal. And as a 15-year-old, were you ready to jump in, or were you thinking like, oh, maybe I'll spend a month in the kitchen chopping and then I'll see if I like it? Or were you thinking to yourself, I'm going to be a chef. I'm going to this restaurant to work.
Yeah, no, none of that. I actually didn't know you could do this for a living. I didn't know a lot of things at that age.
I don't think anyone knows anything at 15.
You really don't. And I don't think, and I say it again, I think if I knew and kind of had this ambition to quote unquote be a chef and had, I don't think I would have lasted. I think it was just fun for me. I think it came to me where I was hanging out with really cool people, you know, inked up, kind of older, drank beers on the line. And I was just like, just fascinated. I felt like I was a part of a fraternity. I just enjoyed it. I watched, my earliest kind of cooking memories aren't like Korean grandma or my mom was a great cook in the kitchen. It was just, I come from an immigrant family and, we just spent a lot of time watching TV and just spending time alone with me and my sister because my parents are working so much. But on Saturdays on PBS, there was this like 3-hour window where Jacques Pepin used to come out, Lydia Bastianich, Rick Bayless, all these kind of like OG. That's when Rick Bayless was kind of new, apparently, too. Like, so like, think about it at that time into the TV kind of world. And I was just so like, like really drawn to that, especially Jacques Pepin. So I was like, oh, that seems really cool. And all of that, that was what I was thinking. I was like, oh, I get to just cook. You know, I get to work in a kitchen. It wasn't like be a restaurant, be a chef and, you know, all of that. I didn't understand any of that.
Did they let you do anything? Were you a mascot? Were you thrown into the mix? What's it like being a 15-year-old at an Aaron Sanchez restaurant? It's like a pretty serious situation. You know,
Absolutely.
He's a real deal chef.
Absolutely. And that's kind of what I still to this day, I thank Chef all the time. And when I see him, even to this day, I just thank him that he didn't treat me like a mascot in his kitchen. Whether you're 14 or whether you're 40, you're a line cook or you're a dishwasher, you're a prep cook. That's your position. You know, you don't. And I remember the first job that I ever had, going, my first task, at least, when I was cooking, I remember it was a Saturday day. He asked me to de-seed some dry chilies, ancho chilies. So great, simple. So like I still had this desire to like prove something to him and kind of I want to do really well. And I remember he was just like, gave me specific instructions. He's like, here, you know, de-seed these, this amount, wear gloves, use this paring knife. Great. I was like, all right, so how do I do it? So I was like, I'm going to do it faster than anybody, but also I'm not going to wear gloves. So that was the first time I did it. I did the whole thing without gloves. My hands are all red and whatnot. And, you know, you're sweating while you're doing it. So you're wiping your forehead and whatnot. And I realized that's when I kind of understood the concept of capsaicin. And when you put it on your skin, that it's really bad news for you. And my first day in the kitchen, I lasted probably one task. So I went home after that. So he was just like, dude, go home. He like put like milk on it and all of that stuff. So he was
learned the hard way that the chef way is the right way.
Yeah, he knows what he's talking about. So I was trying to be a badass. I was like, oh, I don't have to wear gloves. Like, gloves are for losers. And I realized, he probably knows a little bit better how to DC chili. So,
yeah, it's almost the exact opposite of what I would have wondered happened if they, you know, would have played some sort of prank on this 15-year-old who they're maybe trying to get out of their kitchen, you know, dissuade you from going down this path. But you tried to impress them and backfired a little bit.
Yeah, I was the one that was like, oh, I'm going to like really show him and be the star of the kitchen. But realized, just you take the right steps. You know, for the first 6 months, I was doing one task. You know, I was making tortillas. I was on the ceviche.
So were you
station.
Working like one day a week and no. going to school, or what were you doing?
Yeah, so it was great because there was a couple things that I did. All my winter breaks and summer breaks were spent there. Mm-hmm. He graciously just allowed me to, you know, when you work for free, it doesn't really matter. No real set schedule. But school was great. You end at 3 o'clock, you get on a bus, a subway, you get off at Canal Street, Tribeca, walk a few minutes, and you're in the restaurant by like a little before 5, which is great.
What do your parents think? What do your friends in New Jersey make of the fact that you're taking a bus and a train, and you're like a real adult who's going to their job, and your friends are probably like playing video games, right?
Yeah, no, my parents didn't know what was going on. they weren't like, I don't think they would have, not that they don't care. It's kind of more like, don't get in trouble and you're fine. But I think, at least for my friends, I didn't have a lot of friends in high school, so that wasn't a worry. But yeah, no one really, my parents are great in that they're just super supportive. They're like, my dad told me one thing was that do whatever makes you happy, but just don't hurt people in the process and be really good at what you do. That was the only two rules.
What do your parents do for a living?
Mm-hmm. So my parents are the most like generic Korean family job titles. My mom ran a nail salon and my dad owns a limo company.
Okay.
But the limo is not like a real limo. It's a Lincoln Town car. So it's like
that
the most
that he drives?
Or yeah, but he has a few cars, so he kind of runs the company. They all sold the company now. And
so you grew up in New Jersey, and they still live in New Jersey?
Yeah, yeah. In the same town.
And now you're back, but we'll talk about
that in a little while.
After all these years of cooking in a kitchen, you've ended up back in New Jersey.
Yeah, I lost a little bit of my street cred, but it's okay.
With your parents. Well, we'll touch on what you're doing these days in a little while. I want to know, after you spend some time in the kitchen with Aaron Sanchez, how long does it take until you've got the bug and you say, mm-hmm. I'm going to go to culinary school?
It was actually funny. I didn't know, like a lot of things, I didn't know there was a culinary school. Mm-hmm. I didn't know there was a college or an institution where you can learn more about this industry. It was actually Chef Aron was like, you need formal training. And I was like, Chef, I respectfully disagree. I think I'm just going to go with you and let's do this. You know, me and you, ride or die. Uh-huh. And he was like, no, stop being an idiot. Go get formal training. And as any kid at that age would do, you just go to Google. And because I want to still go to the best one. I just typed in best cooking school. Literally those three words. First thing was the Culinary Institute of America. So I applied. I didn't know about Johnson & Wales. There's so many.
Yeah. In CIA in Hyde Park?
Yeah, that was literally the first link that came up. And honestly, if the first link was FCI or Johnson & Wales or some school in Texas, I probably would have gone there.
Well done, SEO CIA. They really they scored their tuition there.
Yeah, no, they made their money worth for sure. And
so you Google CIA.
Yeah, that's literally how
did you go and did you enroll right away? Did you talk to Aaron about CIA, or was it sort of like your own decision, or your parents were behind it?
Yeah, Chef went to Jaewoo. He went to Johnson & Wales. Mm-hmm. So we didn't actually really... He just said go, like get formal training.
Right.
Because I was like, I was already there for a couple of years and I was just like, no, I was like, I'm good. I'm a line cook. I'm like, I know all the stations now. I think I'm like the best.
You're way ahead of the game too. And
yeah, and I didn't realize because it wasn't more... yeah, I didn't know I was that ahead of the game. Actually, back at Culinary Institute, you needed some experience. So you needed, like, I think mm-hmm. back then it was 6 months or a year or something like that. So that's what it was. It was just filling a requirement. But, yeah, Chef was just very stuck on, hey, you need formal training. This is great, but this isn't your life. Formal training and knowing the foundations and fundamentals of cooking will really aid you to go further. So
how did you feel when you arrived in culinary school? And I imagine that quite a few people that were there had, if they had some experience, we're talking like a maybe yeah. 2 months, they did an externship mm-hmm. somewhere, right? They cooked in maybe their parents' restaurant yeah, or something like yeah. that. You got years of experience on yeah. the line in a Manhattan restaurant. Mm-hmm. When you came in, did you feel like you were ahead of the game, or did you feel perhaps like it had, was a mistake?
Mm-hmm. Actually, yeah, I dreaded, and I probably shouldn't say this already, but the first half, because it's 2 years,
yeah,
I dreaded it. And I think a lot of it, looking back on it now, it was a lot of it had to do with my arrogance. You know, I really did feel like I was better than everybody else. Mm-hmm. I was on the line. I was cooking professionally, you know, for a year. So let's say a year, because let's say it took a year to really be an impact on the actual kitchen.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, you know, these guys, like, don't know how to hold a knife, and they're so slow. And looking back on it now, why I didn't have a good time and why I just felt, you know, I just felt I was better than them. I just felt I was better than the school itself. I was like, I don't need this. Even going there, I was like, I don't need this, but I'm going because Chef told me. Looking back on it, a lot of it just stemmed from me and a lot of my attitude and a lot of the arrogance that I had.
So this is a good transition. How humbling was it to leave CIA yeah. and end up in David Chang kitchen?
Yeah. Super, super humbling. That I still say it now. I think the best chefs I've ever worked next to on a line all come from that kitchen. Like really that I respect. For example, just Peter Serpico, Sean Gray, Kevin Pemulier, Joanna Ware. I'm just seeing all these names that maybe aren't like their household to me because they just made an impact on my name. Sean Gray, he runs Co now. He's probably one of the smartest guys that I know on every level, on a culinary sense and whatnot. And being next to a guy like that, cooking next to him, picking his brain was invaluable for, I was 18 at that time. And it was really humbling to know that, okay, you're not that great, you know, and
yeah.
I needed that for sure.
It seems to be one of those kitchens that's going to go down in lore, like
yeah.
everyone who passes through there and yeah. puts in time there has just deep, deep chops.
Yeah.
Was it a hard place to work? Was it challenging mentally mm-hmm. and physically, even with your sort of like cooking pedigree that you've, mm-hmm. that you'd established? Were you welcomed and was it a hard cooking job?
It was hard. I think a lot of it was mentally hard. You know, I was on the bun station for months, you know, and I'm used to running a line, cooking steaks and whatnot. And now I'm making buns and it was really breaking me down. And I think for me as a cook, I was never used to that mental pressure. You know, there's a lot of stories about this. So back then where I was, it was in 08, right when the first Co was about to open. So it was like a couple months, few months before Co was opening. So everyone was on high alert. Chang was just like the epitome of what like Chang's like horror stories are. It was probably his peak. But yeah, just every time he comes into the kitchen, you know, something is, there will be some raising of the volume and of his voice and things, you'll be called out for something. And I've been called out for many different things. It's so funny because it sticks with you. You're angry and you're pissed off at that time. You're like, oh, like, what the hell? Like, why is he yelling at me for that? It's so funny. The next day you don't do it anymore though. And I respond very well.
You quickly learn your lesson.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And all those chefs there were super supportive. They were just like, dude, learn this. This is why we do this. But in that same respect, they expected you to hold your own too. So it wasn't like babying you and they're going to go over like you get as much as you put in with a lot of anything. Right. But especially in Momofuku, they gave you a lot of pride that you were part of a group that I guess was making an impact in the industry. But in that same respect, be humble about kind of you're not that great that you think you are. And it was really inputted into my mind that humbleness was a virtue in cooking.
We're pretty close in age, and we've both run kitchens at a fairly young age. Something that when I was presented with the opportunity, I found totally terrifying. I was incredibly excited, but to not have the ability to lean on someone who's older than you with an extreme amount of experience was very difficult. Personally, I leaned on my brother. He was older, and he was running Roberta's, where we're sitting right now. Who did you go to when you became the executive chef, when you had issues, problems, lapse of confidence here and there? Who do you reach out to in those moments?
That's such a great question. I think and I deal with that even right now, just kind of going into a new chapter in my life. I'm so jealous jealous and not jealous sometimes of when a lot of my friends are working for these big name chefs or these really big pillars in the food industry. You're right. And I think that's where we kind of connect, in that I didn't have a very set culinary mentor to say, hey, you're doing this wrong. Hey, this isn't right. Fix this, fix that. A lot of it for me was my community, and not just like the food community, because it's great. Even now, I have a lot of people that I can call just for quick advices. Hey, is this right? Should I do this? Should I do that? But also even my faith community, right? And I think that's something that I really do talk about a lot, shamelessly, because I really would not be here if I didn't have that element in check. Because you're right, and you know better than anyone how hard it is to run something when you don't have, I guess, the cushion, right, or that kind of the safety net, and thinking, all right, like, even if I mess up, chef's got my back.
Exactly.
Or this person's got my back.
Yeah.
It's on you, you know, and it's a great thing, and that's something that you thrive on. But you sometimes realize there's a big risk on that too. And for me, yeah, my faith and my church community was huge in that.
So beyond that, you know, leaning on them, when you took over at the restaurant in Koreatown, how old were you?
We actually opened it. So it was an empty space. It was a really great experience for me because I saw an empty space and saw a restaurant come out of it. So for me, I was just like, oh, this is how it's done. You know, like, you see when it's construction, you see when we're talking about permitting and licensing, all this stuff. And then when the gas is on, you got to start cooking. I was 25. I remember it opening. I was presented with the project at 24, 25.
It opened. You were still at Momofuku? You were presented with the project?
No, I was
at Jean George?
Yeah, I was at Jean George's, and I joined this group. Kind of their dream was trying to be like a Korean hospitality, or just trying to showcase Korean hospitality in a different way. I kind of like that, and going back to my roots and my culture. But yeah, it was around 24, 25 being presented with that.
What is Korean hospitality? Because I have come to that restaurant when you were still there to eat, and I was blown away by so many things.
Appreciate
but
that.
A couple things that I'll list. We were greeted in a very dramatic fashion when we came in.
Yeah.
It was extremely exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Our server was one of the most energetic people that I've ever met.
Yeah.
And the servers there do all the cooking for you. So unlike other Korean barbecue restaurants where you do some of the cooking on the grill, it's a little bit of and I don't mean this in a negative way, it's a little bit of like a performance. Like,
absolutely.
They put on like a pretty good show, right?
Yeah.
And so I assume that a lot of that comes from you and the management team. But
absolutely.
So how do you make those decisions about like, all right, so you're in a blank space.
Yeah.
How do you guys determine what the vibe is going to be like and what the how the server will interact with
yeah,
people?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't
what
easy.
What are those decisions like?
Yeah, it wasn't easy. I think for us, it's the whole team, right? So the management team, it's for us, I'm in charge of the food. At the end of the day, the food has to be good, because all of that is gimmicks and shows if the food is bad. So me worrying about the food, but you realize, like you just mentioned, our servers are essentially half cooks because they do 50% of the cooking. And you're teaching these college kids and these guys that don't really have any culinary experience how to cook meat perfectly. And these aren't cheap cuts of meat. So when they mess up, you really feel it. You're like, oh, like, no. But yeah, it was, yes, I had 21 guys in my kitchen, but I also had 40 servers/cooks. And it was just creating that vibe. And what you mentioned, what Korean hospitality is, it's just, for me, what I view it as is just large format convivial, drink a lot, eat a lot, laugh. And I love that. And I think Paekchung was a great experience for me because it really embodied that in one space. The greeting that you're talking about is we're just saying hello, you know, but we really want you to know that we really welcome you here.
Yeah.
Something like that, something little like that. These guys practice, you know, greeting you in sync. The servers are, you know, like, really encouraged to know who their guests are and stuff like that. And I think that kind of hospitality is something that I'm really attracted to. Even, you know, when I did leave the restaurant, that's something that I always keep, that kind of philosophy on hospitality.
We definitely are going to touch on what you're doing now. I know that you left. I have another question about the banchan. And sure. Also, there was a egg, corn, uh-huh. cheese that sure. gets poured in sort of a... Like a
little
outside
boat, yeah.
of the grill.
Yeah.
Like there's a little area that collects all this egg and you kind of there an omelet gets made.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that? Is that traditional? Is the banchan that you serve traditional? I know that there's a lot of like chefs and food people listening mm-hmm. that love some people say banchan's the best part of getting the Korean
barbecue.
Agree.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about those flavors that
sure.
you decided on?
Yeah, a lot of the banchans, the little side dishes you get, it's a barbecue. And for us, when we focused on was, let's make it a meat mecca. Let's make it meat focused. So all these banchans, you'll see a lot of acid, a lot of light stuff that really complement fat really well. A lot of heavy cuts of meat, marinated cuts of meat. So you'll see kimchi, obviously, pickled daikon, lettuce with really light dressing, like a soy garlic dressing. And some of the purpose of the banchan is just for you to munch on while you wait for the meat to cook. So everything is in tenfold. So you'll see our banchan is not as plentiful as maybe some other Koreatown restaurants, but everything was with intent. You know, that banchan is there because we want you to eat it while you wait for it. Or it's meant to be eaten with the meat or the pork or whatnot. So even the steamed egg is a very traditional kind of dish, the steamed egg that you get in a Koreatown. But what's a fun way to present it? Why not cook it while your meat is cooking? And the corn and cheese is just freaking delicious. So there's no Korean or culinary reason for that. It's just delicious. And melty cheese and sweet white corn, you can't really go wrong.
I am joined today by Dookie Hong. We are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Koreatown the Cookbook.
New York chefs and restaurants are proud of the food they put on the table. And serving produce that comes from local, environmentally responsible farms is a way to leave an even better taste in everyone's mouth. So when shopping for your ingredients, look for the New York State Grown and Certified Seal. It lets you know which food is grown right here in New York State, certifying the food that comes from local farms that meet a higher standard. You'll not only be serving local food, you'll be supporting local farmers. Learn more about the New York State Grown and Certified Program at certified.ny.gov.
Welcome back to The Line. I'm joined today by Dookie Hong. He was previously the chef of, say it for me.
Paekchung. New York City.
Right.
Koreatown.
And he is going to talk a little bit about his new project in a little while, but we are going to launch into Koreatown the Cookbook. You are the co-author of this.
Yeah.
And it took you about 2 years to write it. Tell us first a little bit about how you met Matt, your co-author, who's an awesome dude.
Absolutely.
I love Matt.
Our mutual friend, yeah.
And I want to know about some of the exploring that you had to do in order to do research for this cookbook. You went to a bunch of different cities.
Yep.
Let us know where you went.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. Koreatown, it came out this February, earlier on this year, and we mentioned Matt Rodbard. He's a journalist, food journalist out of New York City, and he's a great friend to both of ours. And honestly, this book came out of it was his brainchild. It's 100% him. And you know, when people look at this project, they think, oh, probably the Korean guy thought about the Korean book. No, it's the Jewish guy in the project that thought about the book. And I felt. More like, I don't know, the token Korean guy kind of on the project to legitimize or give it some credit. But no, like all joking aside, I think the book became something of its own. You know, we didn't know what we were doing. You know, Matt and I would be the first to tell you, we didn't know what the hell we were doing. I still don't think we know what the hell we were doing regarding the book. It was just embraced by the industry, embraced by the community, the Korean community, and and not even the Korean community. So, you know, like you mentioned, we spent 2 years on the road going to New York, L.A., and any Koreatowns in between, any city that would have us, we were there. And Matt really just wanted to have a Korean book, a Korean cooking book that wasn't like grandma's cooking made simple or Korean food dumbed down. You know, it was just Korean food in our voice, kind of how we would mention it to our friends. So obviously we traveled to New York and LA, kind of the two biggest Korean towns. But yeah, Chicago, Atlanta, Houston. I don't know why we were in Madison, Wisconsin, but we were in Madison, Wisconsin, DC, obviously all these cities. And yeah, we learned a lot, and we had an incredible photographer named Sam Horine, and he documented all of this. And yeah, I learned a lot as a Korean, even myself, even thinking, oh, I know this cuisine, I know this and that, I know Koreatowns, I live in one of the best ones in the country. But I learned a tremendous amount, and there's stark differences in all these Koreatowns in every city. Like, I couldn't name you one Koreatown that was even remotely similar to the next. You know, LA is so different from New York, Atlanta is different from Dallas, and Dallas is different from Chicago. So it was a really big learning experience for me, and it was fun. I mean, we were going in and we were like pretending to be bloggers, because most of these Korean establishments won't let you like take pictures because they think you're stealing recipes for some reason. I don't know. We were doing photo shoots in like the parking lot of a Motel 6. Like, legit, we would lay it out because Sam was like, this is perfect lighting, we got to like get it. There was a lot of stuff where, because we didn't know how to make a cookbook, it just kind of made it more special. We didn't have any boundaries, too.
So, you know, you're born in New Jersey.
Yeah.
And your parents were born in the United States or no?
Yeah, I actually lied. I'm not born in New Jersey.
Oh, okay.
I was born in Korea.
Oh, you were.
Came here
okay.
when I was a toddler, one or two. Ended up in Texas. Lived there for a few years. Ended up in Alabama, lived there for a couple of years, and then moved our way up to Jersey, New York.
So you spent all of your real childhood, anything that you can remember, in the United States.
Yeah.
Was this a deeper experience for you beyond writing a cookbook? Can you talk a little bit about, did you learn any, not to be totally cliched, but did you learn something about yourself while writing this cookbook that you did not know? And also, how did this impact your relationship with your family and your parents by going on really like a full-on exploration of Korean food and Korean
Absolutely.
Culture?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think for me, I learned an incredible amount. Forget if you remove the food element to this, it really reads like a culture book. We have a lot of people involved in it. And for me personally, as a Korean American, just seeing how other Koreans live in different cities. I mean, you don't understand why there's a Korean restaurant next to a Korean laundromat, next to a dry clean, like all of these things. And that's our Koreatown. So when we define Koreatown, it wasn't like kind of what you think. It doesn't have to be a big city or a big block. It was maybe two Korean restaurants next to a Korean supermarket. That was Koreatown to us. And for me, obviously, it was this big sense of pride as a Korean myself. And for me, I was just like, wow, the kind of the grit, I don't really know how to call it, but that grit or that tenacity to survive in a place like a Korean, Asian person to survive in Houston or in the middle of Madison, Wisconsin. Like, why are you? I keep remembering while I was there, I was like, why am I here? And I meet another Korean. I was like, why are you here? Like, what got you here? And all of these things, you still realize that Koreans, no matter where they are, you can drop them off in the middle of a desert, they'll try to keep their culture. You know, we don't. Yes, of course, there's some blending. Of course, there's Atlanta's a great example. There's a chef named Cody Taylor and Chi-Yun Lee. They do heirloom barbecue. It's an American barbecue joint. You go in, it's like briskets, ribs, great. You ask them how they made it. It's Korean soybean paste, Korean chili paste. So you don't know why it's good and why it's delicious or what's so different about it. But it's, you know, rooted in kind of Chef Chi-Yun, who's Korean. So they will adapt, but they'll always kind of keep their heritage and keep their culture. And that's something that I was really proud of.
That's so interesting about what's happening in Atlanta because, you know, if you don't tell people we rub it with gochujang, right, or whatever, but it's so delicious and it has such a massive, intense flavor to it. And essentially, they're making barbecue, right?
Yeah.
And so I used to live in L.A. and I went to a lot of Korean barbecue restaurants in L.A. There was this place when I moved there and had sort of this lore. It was called the Corner Place, and had this cold noodles.
Cold noodle
soup lore.
Yeah.
Are there tons of places that have like an exclusive recipe that they do the best version of? And do you agree with that? Did you find any places and you thought, oh my God, I've been traveling around the United States.
Yeah.
This is the best
100%
something that I ate.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of Korean restaurants or even Asian restaurants in general, they really focus on kind of single varietal, if you use a wine term, kind of restaurant, single concept. So, hey, if this guy makes really good noodles, he's just making noodles and it's really good. If he makes good stew, he's making this type of stew and it's really damn good. LA was a great example. Corner Place is a perfect example. They do these, it's called tongchimi, cold radish, water, kimchi noodles. And you just go for that. Like, yes, they have barbecue and it's a barbecue place. You don't eat the barbecue. You just go just for that.
I just remember people saying like, just go and eat this cold noodle, cucumbery.
Don't waste your time with a barbecue.
Slightly gelatinous, watery soup.
Yeah, it's so refreshing.
I think of it all the time.
Yeah.
Matt, after we went to your restaurant, Matt took us to Pochu 32. Is that it?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And we had an army stew.
That's what they're known for.
Can you tell a little bit about army stew?
Yeah.
To me, it was such a unique item and I had no familiarity with it whatsoever before eating it.
Yeah. I mean, obviously Korea. So that's a perfect example of a dish, how culture affects food. You know, culture expects really impacts a country's cuisine. And that's a dish well liked and loved by Koreans, you know. But, you know, that's a dish that was kind of invented by kind of the army, the U.S. Army in the 1950s when the Korean War was happening or ended. The U.S. Army would settle base near the DMZ. So we would have all these American products. We would have Spam. We would have Hershey's chocolate. We would have Boston baked beans. So American cheese, right? So all of this, but we have kimchi, which is what we like. So this dish is a perfect mashup of what they would have eaten near the army base, kind of the town surrounding. So when you go to Korea, there's small pockets or small towns and villages that specializes in the best budae-jjigae, right? The best army stews. And you see geologically, they're located near the DMZ, near the army bases, naturally, right?
I want to shift gears a little bit and ask your perspective. As a chef who has been working in cooking Korean food the most recently, do you have an opinion on sort of the fetishization of Korean food and Korean barbecue as sort of like it's such a wild out there thing that like, you know, a bunch of, you know, white people show up and they go and it's like their crazy night on 33rd Street in the middle of Manhattan. Like it's some totally obscure thing that can never be done. What are your thoughts on like the Instagram culture and how that's kind of fueled that scenario?
Yeah. Kind of Korean food and how it's kind of maybe even over glorified. Right. And I think, for me, I remember starting this. I don't cook Korean food because I'm Korean or I just have this, like, I want to wave the flag or whatnot. I just genuinely love eating Korean food. I genuinely, when I crave stuff, it's usually Korean food. Yes, I crave tacos every now and then when I'm in LA and whatnot, but I just try to cook food that I love to eat. And that's how I cook. You know, Jean Georges, the Three Michelin Star fine dining was great and great for my experience, but I don't eat like that, you know, so how could I really cook with my heart like that, as cliche as that sounds? So for me, when Korean food is just, it's a very simple thing. And when I started this, when I started cooking Korean food, I was like, I just wanted to be part of the conversation. I just want a Midwestern family, a family from Kansas saying, hey, what do you guys want for, what do you guys want for dinner? All right. Chinese might be in the conversation, pizza, American, some way down the road, maybe 50 years later, 100 years later, I want some really middle America family saying, oh, what about Korean, right? If that happens, I'm good. We're good. I don't care if it's Instagrammed 1,000 times or
but does we've it, done okay. Does it bother you that, like, the food community seems to have just discovered Korean food and, like, obviously, it's been delicious for a very long time.
I had a chef at Jean Georges that he said the same thing. This is in 2009, before I would say even the past 5 years where all this Korean food kind of blew up.
Yeah.
He was like, dude, I don't know why Korean food is not liked, because it has the same flavor profile as what Americans love. It's got the sweetness. It's got the spiciness. It's got the savory. And I was like, chef, I agree. I don't know what to tell you. am I first? No, I'm just appreciative. Hey, better late than never. And we're just glad that people are enjoying our food. And who cares if it's, you know, if it wasn't for 20 years like Japanese food was or Chinese food was. We're just glad that we just get an opportunity to represent our culture and our food. You know?
So what are you doing now? I know that you've left the restaurant, and there were some news reports that you were working on sort of a hospitality type of project. Can you let the listeners know where your head's at? Where are you heading now?
Yeah, I mean, hospitality group was my dream, so I think that kind of got skewed a little bit, where you don't go and, you know, try to build a house, like try to build a mansion. You know, you start by laying one brick at a time, right? So for me, that's my mentality. It starts with one concept, you know, and you have to gain your customers and your guests' trust, right? You can't just be like, oh, I'm going to do this big thing and think people are going to come and lining up. You have to do concepts, start one concept at a time where you build your clients, your guests' trust. So that's kind of what I'm working on right now, one concept at a time. My goal and my dream is to have a hospitality group that really empowers young, talented chefs or sommeliers or service people kind of with the same vision. You know, I'm a firm believer that when you gather the right people, the right product will come. You know, I'm not like stuck on this $1 million idea or this restaurant concept, like, all right, let's like do this. You know, I'm just like, no, I want that really like badass chef or that badass wine guy, badass, you know, service person. And then I'm sure if we gather all of us in a room, we can come out with a pretty cool concept or a pretty cool bar, whatever idea. So that was my dream. I think right now we're just kind of taking a step back and be like, all right, let's start with one concept. What do you want to do? Right now I'm just working on a concept where I think for the past couple of years, maybe for the past year, I wasn't a part of a project that I was really into. And this is not a knock on anybody and whatnot, but I want to start doing projects that I fully believe in, that I can go all in and with no hesitation. I don't think I've had that. I think going forward, and I realize it's a privilege. I realize that I'm part of the 1% of the 1% that has an ability to even fathom this kind of, like, have the opportunity to go the direction that I want to go and not go the direction that I'm told to go. Mm-hmm. You know, so I want to take advantage of that. But in that same process, while I go, I want to kind of empower a lot of the chefs that I've met through the travels of the book and just personally where, damn, like, they're so talented, but they may not have the resources or the network. But maybe I have, or maybe my other friend has. So how do we do that and give them a platform, give them a chance to showcase what they're really passionate about? So that's kind of what I'm working on. It's very vague, but I'm sorry, brother. it's one step at a time.
Do you think we will see you in a kitchen again in the next year or two?
Absolutely. I would go crazy if I wasn't in the kitchen. I go crazy right now that I'm not in the kitchen. In the next year, you will definitely see me in the kitchen, possibly multiple kitchens, not necessarily in New York. I want to, the hospitality.
Any idea group, if it's not New York, where it might be? Cities that you're thinking of?
Any city is open game. Whichever city will have us, whichever city needs us, right? I think just for Korean barbecue sake, honestly, I wouldn't want to open up a Korean barbecue in a city like LA where every other block is some Korean barbecue. That's a good Korean barbecue.
Yeah.
Maybe do it in a city where, maybe like Denver, where it's not so well known or there's not that many there. So we always want to fill a need, fill a void, and we want to do it right. So I think I'm excited for that, but we want to be kind of really intentional with how we do it, but not rush things. So, yeah.
Cool. Well, it sounds like you've got a big year ahead of you.
I cannot
wait to have you come back down the line, on the line,
that.
And talk more about whatever this project may be when it comes to fruition. It's been really cool hearing about everywhere that you've worked and all the exciting projects that you've already got under your belt. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, I'm really thank you for just allowing me on your platform once again and letting me share my story. This is incredible for you. I know you're starting out this show, and this is like a huge opportunity for you, and this is a dream of mine that you're doing, so I'm so jealous because you get to share other people's stories and you're so good at it. So thank you.
Thanks, man. It was awesome to hear your story. Thanks for listening. This is The Line every Tuesday at 11 a.m. on Heritage Radio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.